And we're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU-FM, broadcasting to Hamilton at 93.3 on the FM dial, and the rest of the world at cfmu.mcmaster.ca, our online streaming service. I'm pleased to say today we have Alfredo Lopez with us. He is a member of the leadership committee of the May 1st People Link. You can actually find that online at mayfirst.org. That's HTTP and all that stuff, and then mayfirst.org. And I think we have Alfredo on the line with us. Hi, Alfredo. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. Pleasure to be with you.
It's a pleasure to have you on the program. I told our listeners that we were going to have some information updates about Venezuela, you know, what they're doing, the challenges that they're facing, and certainly you've been writing about the challenges. Back in March, you wrote an article, what you called Venezuela's Continuous Coup, and I think it was evocative of the nature of your article and how it was pretty detailed and informative. And I think what you're writing about in this article, which was published on Counterpunch, well, no, it was published on This Can't Be Happening, and it was reproduced by Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. It got around. I sent it around. And, you know, it was about the fundamental political and economic change that's been happening in Venezuela and some of the efforts to fight it. And I think early on in the article, I mean, you talked about what you meant when you're talking about a coup, but you had to explain what is happening in Venezuela, what this Bolivarian process or revolution is doing. And you talked about some of the achievements or programs or projects of this this Bolivarian movement in Venezuela. So I was wondering if you could start just by telling us a little about the content of what's going on there. You know, what has that government been doing since Chavez was elected? You know, what are some of these initiatives that the government has pursued?
Well, I mean, it on various levels, it's, I mean, I've been a movement activist now for about a half century, nearly 48 years, nearly 50 years, and it's the most remarkable social project I've ever seen in my own life. Things are happening at various levels. First of all, the very existence of the Bolivarian Revolution, which essentially is a movement of led by poor people. A movement that stresses the concept of a just society being one in which nobody's poor. That doesn't mean everybody's going to be rich or that perhaps anybody's going to be rich, but nobody is poor. It also means that everybody is going to participate in an electoral process that elects the government, places the government, and sets the national agenda. It's really important to understand that this happens at a time, this is 1999 when Chavez is first elected, this happens at a time when Latin America is still emerging from a period where the average government was a dictatorship. And there are a series of revolutionary, democratic revolutions taking place throughout Latin America, of which Venezuela is very, very prominent and part of the motive force. Most countries in Latin America today elect their government. 25 years ago, this was not the case. So that in and of itself is a huge step forward. When the Bolivarian Revolution developed and took power in 1999, two elections, they did a number of things. First thing that they did was they empowered huge numbers of poor people to vote. Now, this is really important, much more important than people in the United States think about or Canada might think about voter registration. That's not what this is, because many parts of Venezuela were not on the registration map of the country and the government, and so the government did not have any services for them. So if you're not a registered zone, electoral zone in Venezuela, the government does not owe you water service. It doesn't owe you electricity service. Those things are not automatic. So under the Bolivarian Revolutionary Government, all of that stuff was registered. There's not an inch of Venezuela that is not today registered. The participation among poor people in the elections has jumped dramatically. And so as a result of that, there are a number of social reforms that emanate. They're pretty spectacular. You know, 93% of the kids in Venezuela are now in primary schools. That's increased by it's about 7 million new students since 1999. And many of them are from agricultural areas. That's the primary place they're from. Some from poor urban areas as well. The percentage of students, though, who go on to university, which is a major issue in Latin America, that's a major thermometer for what is successful and what is not. In 1999, about less than 30%, about 28% of the youngsters in high school and secondary school went on to college. Today, it's 78%. 78% of that society's young people go to university in Venezuela. And that's because the Chavez government created the first free university system in the country's history. 13 institutions make up that system in all parts of the country. There are parts of Venezuela with there was no school. I mean, today there are universities in a lot of those parts. So it's one of the most dramatic educational leaps in hemispheric history. And that goes hand in hand with the attack on poverty. The poverty's been cut by half. Let's say 2014, that toward the end of 2014, actually, it had Venezuela had the highest average standard of living in Latin America. When the Chavez government took over, this is really, really stunning. Half the country was under the poverty line. In other words, more than 50% of Venezuela's people were in poverty, living in poverty. And 23% were in what's called by the international bodies extreme poverty, which means you have no way of knowing where your next meal is going to come from. By 2011, they had cut the number of people under poverty line to 23% and 8% in extreme poverty. That no other country in modern history has done something like that in a decade. I mean, that is truly remarkable stuff. And as a result, there's this huge increase in food consumption and the drop in malnutrition. You know, the malnutrition in Venezuela was at 13.5% in the early 1990s, and by 2010, it's like at 5%. The UN has given it a standing ovation for those kinds of numbers, because the UN loves stuff about poverty and food and nutrition and, you know, all that other stuff. So these are changes that are fundamental. It's one of the most remarkable social experiments in contemporary human history.
Yes, I mean, the people of Venezuela were, in a sense, victims of a prior social experiment, and that neoliberalism and globalization was, you know, wreaked upon them as heavily as anywhere else in the 90s. It caused a lot of difficult conditions that were partly responsible for the ascension of Hugo Chavez. This is something that we're seeing in the region generally, that there's a number of countries that were getting fed up with the order of globalization as it was, and were seeking to chart their own path. I'm reminded that it was a few years back, Noam Chomsky wrote an article saying good things are happening in South America. And, right. You know, he's referring to the variety of movements and things that were happening. And what Venezuela was doing, you know, domestically, they were also doing in terms of foreign policy and foreign issues. As you pointed out, it's not just a matter of lowering poverty or redistributing money, but it was about involving people in the political process and making people citizens who weren't citizens before.
Right.
You know, recognizing neighborhoods, recognizing places that existed but were unrecognized. I was briefly in Venezuela for a week or so during the World Social Forum a few years ago, and I saw that this process extended into the barrios. You know, you could see that there were people that were involved in this, people who probably didn't have much of a say politically 20 years ago, and now they're involved. And that means, you know, you gotta be active at the international level too, to change the nature of trade agreements, international agreements. Your article, you mentioned some of the things that, you know, Venezuela was doing outside of the country in terms of organizing Latin America or South America. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
There's several networks that Venezuela has pushed. The most prominent of that, the one that everyone knows, is ALBA. The Alliance of the People's Bolivarian Alliance of the American People, the People of our America, and there are 11 members. which include Barbuda and Bolivia, Cuba, Ecuador, Nicaragua, and some of the island nations, and of course Venezuela, which acts as a counterweight to the Organization of American States. There's also several other networks that are very specific around, for example, trade with, in terms of petroleum, solidarity trade, etc. You know, Venezuela is one of the, you know, it's one of the largest petroleum producers in the world. It has a huge, huge supply of petroleum, which is what has financed many of these social reforms. But what Venezuela has tried to do is, rather than do the traditional thing with natural resources, which is exploit them and then try to get rich off of them, Venezuela has turned that around. Instead of getting rich off of the oil deposits, what you do is you sell those oil deposits internationally and invest the money domestically. And in some cases, you trade those deposits internationally for other forms of aid to your own country. So, for example, the relationship between Venezuela and Cuba is extremely deep, because Venezuela gives Cuba a huge amount of its petroleum. If you've ever been to Cuba, you know, we all know, petroleum is a major issue in Cuba, major problem. They don't have enough of it. They don't produce it, and they don't have the money to buy it on the fluctuating international market as much as they need anyway to really develop the country. Venezuela is just pouring petroleum in there. And in exchange for that, Cuba, rather than follow the normal capitalist, the old-fashioned capitalist mode of paying the price and then haggling over the price and trying to get as little a price as you can and all that idiocy, what they said was, you give us the oil, we'll send you doctors, social workers, and construction workers. That's people that you need. So with Cuban doctors, Venezuela was able to open one of the most sophisticated community health systems in the entirety of South America. And it's actually a model. I am not exaggerating. Many other South American countries are now looking at Venezuela's community health system and modeling after it. Well, that's Cubans. Cubans are the leaders in health in Latin America. I mean, maybe people don't know this that are listening, but they get every year. The way you tell this is a new year is that the United Nations or some health agency is recognizing Cuba for a new health care achievement. Every year they get something new, eliminating this or combating that or, you know, making advances in the other. And so that's the thing they export to Venezuela. This kind of leadership, you know, Venezuela putting this type of thing together is part of what that Bolivarian Revolution is about. Because, see, Bennett, they're trying to survive the present, but they're trying to model the future. And that's the danger Venezuela poses to something like the United States. It is not that the country is doing anything very dangerous to the U.S. right now. It's what it means in terms of the future, what it is modeling, how it is influencing other people. That's the problem, and that is the fulcrum of the constant threat coup that the United States is involved in.
Yes, it's the threat of a good example, as some people have put it. We can't have a good example in Latin America. If you're in Cuba, you can talk to people on the street. I was there when Chavez was still alive, and people, you know, you could talk to an average person on the street, and they would have very glowing things to say about Hugo Chavez, because they understood Venezuela's role in helping with their energy economy in Cuba. Likewise, it's my understanding that the medical doctors and the medical program from Cuba is much appreciated among those who are recipients of it in Venezuela. You know, there's a lot of human development indicators that have improved in Venezuela. And, you know, as you point out, actually, I'm going to quote your article. You said, in a just world, this social project would be universally acclaimed and supported. In today's unjust world, Venezuela has lived under relentless political and physical sabotage as a result of its successes. And what you've said so far kind of points out as to who would be upset by some of these developments in Venezuela. And so you have the building of counter-organizations or organizations that are outside of U.S.-based organizations. You have relationships like the Cuba-Venezuela one where they're exchanging goods and services that are not part of the international financial system. So Wall Street does not get a cut of this, basically. And then you have an alternative economic, political, social model in Venezuela that's not part of the Washington consensus. So, you know, it's interesting that they're doing all this, and it's generated opposition from the United States, and it's generated domestic opposition in Venezuela, and we can talk about that. I mean, it's interesting. We live in a world where these kind of things are said to be impossible. Like, people will tell us here in Canada, well, you can't have free education, or, you know, government can't bail out the poor, or, you know, basically, they would tell us that many, if not all, of the programs that we're seeing enacted in Venezuela are actually not possible, economically or politically or otherwise. Now, they have been able to do this because of the way that they've utilized oil revenue and things like that. That has issues of its own, which I know you want to tell us about. But let's get to the subject, or the main subject of your article for the moment, which is this continuous coup. You say that Venezuela is under a continuous coup. So what is this coup? Why is it continuous?
Well, the general plan of the opposition in Venezuela is not to organize every 4 years for a new election, et cetera, but it is to disrupt the basic and fundamental social processes that make the Venezuelan government popular among its constituency. So there's all kinds of sabotage going on. I'm talking about constant sabotage of stuff. You know, the disruption of the flow of consumer goods. Companies pulling their stores. Yeah, Venezuelan consumer companies pulling their stores out of the country. All their stores out of the country and putting them elsewhere. All of that, you know, besides the constant agitation to overthrow the government. And see, the coup is not, you can't have a coup in a country where everything is perfect. But in the real world, there is no such place. In the real world, you're always going to have limitations and difficulties. And the coup is about choosing. There are two options when you have difficulties. One is that everybody get together and figure out what the difficulties are and solve them internationally and nationally. The other one is to get rid of the government. And if they get rid of the government, they go backwards. Now, people debate, is this real? Is it just opposition? We know this is real. We have tapes. We have email. We have documents from the Venezuelan oppositionists who are constantly in touch with each other and with people in the United States State Department attempting to or talking about how they want to disrupt the Bolivarian Revolution's social processes, forcing a chipping away at the popularity of it, and then hopefully taking over in some kind of rapid electoral process, emergency electoral process, or if necessary, a military process.
Yes.
Nobody can tell me, not a person in the world can tell me, that I am being extremist or whatever you want to call it, delusionary or whatever other terms the people use it when we say this, when I make the statement that the forces in Venezuela are poised for a physical military coup. And the reason for that is they did one. In 2002, the military elite of Venezuela and many of the right-wing elements in Venezuela did a coup. They arrested the president. They took over the presidential palace. They closed down the radio and television stations. They called a curfew where no one was allowed to go out. And then they let the United States, the United States already knew what was happening. That was, you know, it had been planned. But the United States was poised to recognize it. These idiots thought the Venezuelan people were going to take this laying down. Well, the moment word got out that they had arrested Chavez, that whole Bolivarian movement just went crazy. It just flooded out of those poor areas. And, you know, in two blinks of an eye, in a day and a half, there were about 100,000 people in front of the presidential palace. And then at that point, of course, the presidential guard, that is, those are revolutionary forces within the military. Those are Chavez's forces. Retook the palace and arrested the people who had done the coup. Those who weren't arrested fled.
Yeah,
they had to flee the country.
The people involved in the coup forgot why Chavez had come to power in the first place. It was because there was a wide base of support for all these changes in Venezuela. And you mentioned as much in the article, as well as how the Venezuelan media, as soon as Chavez was kidnapped and moved by the military, they said there was a coordinated talk about Chavez being ousted. It was very rapid, and all the media outlets, the private media outlets, at once acted on it, just like the U.S. was immediately recognizing it. This was a coordinated action, and it was understood as such in the films and documentaries that were later made about that coup. But, you know, what you're saying in the article is that coup d'etat was not, or the coup attempt, at least, was not an isolated incident. They're always trying to disrupt processes and mechanisms of the government, and it's interesting, the opposition in Venezuela, which is more of an elite opposition in terms of the composition of it, it has not done so well in elections, but it is always looking for extra parliamentary means to do things, and also it looks to support from outside because it doesn't seem to be able to get enough domestic support from the inside to change the government. We had that interesting recording in 2013 between an opposition leader, was it Ramon Avellano, and the U.S. Undersecretary of State for Latin America. Can you tell us about that recording?
Opposition leader Maria Corina Machado, who's just a horrible anti-Chavista person, just horrible, I mean, really classist and racist and stuff, reveals this detailed conversation between Avellano, who's a right-wing. It's important to say the opposition to this are really bad news right-wingers. I mean, you don't have to feel guilty about opposing them. They're just really, really bad right-wing, all of them, extreme right-wingers, no matter what their rhetoric is. So Avellano sits down with a person in the State Department named Roberta Jacobson. Roberta Jacobson is a career diplomat. She is an undersecretary. In 2013, she was the undersecretary of state for Latin America. So you can imagine what kind of connections Ms. Jacobson has. So Avellano tells the State Department that the only way to resolve all of this stuff happening around Cuba is by provoking and accentuating a crisis. As Machado says, a coup or a self-coup. Or, as she puts it, and I'll quote exactly, or a process of tightening the screws and domesticating to generate a system of total social control. Now, elsewhere in the tape, this is probably the most interesting of the quotes, maybe not the most important, but the most interesting, we have to raise the political costs for these vagabonds, as she calls the people in the Maduro government, beginning with the gringos, followed by the Colombians, the Brazilians, etc. So what basically she's saying is, on the one hand, you cause crisis. On the other hand, you cause isolation. That's what she tells the state. That's what he tells the State Department. Avellano tells the Undersecretary of State. I don't know how many conversations of this type they've had. I'm sure they have many. But that's a very, very important process. On the one hand, you generate the crisis. On the other hand, you generate the isolation. Well, what did we have this month? We have the President of the United States going to this huge convergence of Latin American countries and doing an elaborate dance with the Cuban leadership, the Cuban government leadership under Raul Castro. And I have no fear that Raul Castro is one of the great veterans of diplomacy, international diplomacy, and revolutionary leadership. There's no way Brother Obama's going to fool him into isolating from Venezuela. But that's what they try to do. That's how they handle this whole thing. In a just world, you embrace Venezuela. In this world, they try to isolate it. And, you know, that shows that there's a continuous process. Listen, Brendan, this is in 2013, the tape you and I are referring to. 2013. That's 11 years after the coup, and these guys are still at this. There were recent arrests in Venezuela, as you know, last year. And the commercial media, the mass media, all talked about, oh, how horrible this is. These people are thrown in jail, et cetera, et cetera. In Venezuela, let's be clear, the arrests of the coup plotters that's been denounced in, let's say, I know here in the United States, the mass media's been denouncing it. It was massively applauded in demonstrations, by popular demonstrations, by Venezuelans in the street. Because of the fundamental hatred they have of these people who are always insulting them. And if you listen to any of these right-wingers, just, I mean, you know, I encourage anyone who's hearing me, all of our friends who are tuning into these various broadcasts, don't listen to what the commercial media says about these guys. Try to get these people's quotes themselves, the real quotes of what they say. And in their own conference, etc., it'll turn your stomach. The arrogance, the elitism, the classism, the racism.
Oh, well, I've seen it myself, Alfredo. Here in
oh, it's horrible.
In Toronto, there's a Venezuelan expatriate community. Some of them are pro-Chavez, pro-revolution. Others are not. And when Maduro was running for president, as you have pointed out, Maduro is a working class guy, a man of the people. But he was a bus driver. And I saw they were posting on Facebook in Toronto, people opposing the Venezuelan government. They said, how could you elect a bus driver to be president? You know, it's like, you know, this guy doesn't belong there. He's making it look bad. You know, their idea was that you need to be a high born or higher class person in order to be the leader, of Venezuela. There's, as you point out, there's enormous what you would call classism, I suppose, among supporters of the opposition. And this is why they're upset. The natural order for them has been upset. People like Maduro and Chavez and others, poor people are coming out of their barrios into the polls. People are forming, you know, committees, constitutional reform. They're saying, we want to be involved in the political process. And democracy is an ugly thing for those who are privileged, especially, you know, because you see all these people, who are these people? They come out and they want a say in things. And, you know, economically, it's caused issues, as you've pointed out, because the government has said, well, we should be able to feed people. We should be able to house people. And that's increased the demand that's being recognized by the government and in the economy. So more people, they want more things, and now the government has to build more things, provide more things, and that's difficult because the wealthy in Venezuela can engage in capital flight. They can move their money out, they can move companies out, which they're doing, because there's a lot of large-scale private industry in Venezuela. That's one of the things people don't seem to understand. Venezuela is still a market economy, and has a very powerful 1%, just like in the United States. It has a very open and free media. At least when I was there, I saw quite a level of political engagement. There are some pro-Chavez newspapers and whatnot at the newspaper stand, but most of that was distributed in the streets. In most newspaper stands, there was a lot of corporate media, which there was quite a lot of variety, actually, a lot of publications. Many of them were angry and saying hateful things about the Venezuelan government. It was under Chavez at that time. One of the newspapers I saw called him a monkey, or compared him to a monkey. I mean, you know, you can say just about anything about the government, it would seem.
Yeah.
I've never seen such a politically engaged populace, and people were in the streets. I was at a restaurant. Some restaurant owner said, oh, I don't like the government. I don't like how it affects my business, or it's probably bad for business. A person drove by in a Mercedes and shouted, Fuera Chavez, which out with Chavez, at me. At the same time, there are all these other demonstrations and people in the streets supporting the government. This is what it means to be involved in politics and the political process and democracy. And it's always been exciting, but also been very difficult in Venezuela. I know your article, and we probably don't have time to cover it today, but your article looked at the oil situation. How does Venezuela make these changes possible? And you talked about the use of oil for a country. And because we know there's a lot of countries that have oil that don't really spend it on their own population. A lot of countries squander their oil wealth. And it's interesting because some of these places, there's massive poverty, people that don't have houses, they don't have anything, there's people raking in the oil wealth. Some of these are monarchies, and they don't seem to be bothered by the United States. The U.S. says these guys are okay. And if, you know, the Saudi Arabian king dies, he gets eulogies by the president and the vice president of the United States, and everyone says what a good guy and a reformer he was. But when you have Chavez die, you just have more insults from Canada and from the United States. Canada being a country that largely squanders its oil wealth on its own. So it's interesting to see that difference, and I think it's unfortunate that countries like Venezuela are just not allowed to chart their own path. You know, they're out making arrangements and agreements with other countries in the region, new organizations and such, but it seems that the United States doesn't care much for its sovereignty as it keeps engaging in these strategies with the opposition.
Right. Well, I need to say things quickly because I know that I've gone on a tad. But it's the oil issue that's a major issue in Venezuela. For what you just said, and that it is turning the concept of a monoculture on its head. You know, the oil is what's driven much of this reform, and it's conscious. And Venezuela uses it nationally, internationally. The problem is in this world today, this world is a mixed economic world. Venezuela is not a socialist country. It may be a socialist government, but it's still a capitalist country, and that means that oil has a price. And when the price of oil falls, that has a political impact on all of the programs, and that's what's happened in Venezuela. The price of oil fell dramatically, pretty near collapsed, from $100 a barrel to $40 a barrel. It's now starting to pick up slowly, and probably by the end of this year, we'll see some normalization of prices at around $75 U.S. a barrel. And so you'll see some, rejuvenation and pickup. But that has had a huge impact on the social programs of Venezuela. It's one of the criticisms people make of that government, which is that while there have been many, 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 there's amazing social experiments, the government, and there has been nationalization of some industries, many of the industries remain in private hands. Many of the most popular industries or most powerful industries and companies remain in private hands. The oil pricing situation keeps Venezuela enslaved to a certain extent to the international capitalist markets. All of that, these are political problems that the government of Venezuela needs to be discussing and solving. And there are people in Venezuela who are raising this all the time. Revolutionaries who in spirit are comrades of this government, but extremely critical of its path. But here's the problem. You can't have a family discussion over the dinner table when there's a bunch of guys breaking down the door to rob you and shoot you. You know, your priority is going to be the protection of your family and the protection of your home. Same thing with a place like Venezuela. There's no time for those kinds of conversations if you're fighting a coup every day. And that is, in my opinion, the greatest casualty of this constant coup. It is the inability of the Venezuelan people to actually discuss their project among themselves and with the other countries of the world. You know, other countries who have been through different kinds of situations can sit down with Venezuela and say, no, you're doing this wrong. Do try this, try that. Venezuelan people, Venezuela should have a massive congress of people. What do we do about petroleum? What do we do? These people can advise. The people in Venezuela are smart enough to put the government in there. They can make those changes. But how are you going to do that when they're trying to overthrow the government every day? And this is the problem. So, I think that the people of the world, starting with the United States and Canada, starting with Toronto, which is one of my favorite cities in the world, by the way, I love it dearly. But starting with the people of these two places, the thing we have to say to our governments is keep your filthy hands off Venezuela and recognize it. These countries don't recognize the government. They have no relations with Venezuela. It's an elected government. You've got to recognize it. Normalize the relations. Stop threatening it. Obama needs to stop calling it the major risk and all the other stuff that he said, which is very alarming and alarmist. And, you know, just allow that process to take hold and to develop. You know, that's the right that the Venezuelan people have. And I think that's the right that the rest of the people in the world have in terms of what should happen in Venezuela.
Yeah, you think if we were living in a free world, then people would have the freedom to choose how to run their governments. But, you know, I think people, I'd recommend they look at your article. It's called Venezuela's Continuous Coup, and it's not This Can't Be Happening, .net. This Can't Be Happening. You can find Alfredo's many articles there, including this one called Venezuela's Continuous Coup. And in that article, he also details the oil situation and the choices that Venezuela faces and the difficulties in trying to use oil in the way that they do, as well as other issues, including more detail on just how the opposition keeps shaking things, shaking the country in an effort to dislodge the government, which is harming dialogue in the country. So there's a lot that could be said, and I'm glad you wrote about that. So thanks very much, Alfredo, for being on the program with us today.
Hey, it's great talking to you, Ben. Thanks a million.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And again, that was Alfredo Lopez. The article is called Venezuela's Continuous Coup. It's at This Can't Be Happening. I think that's thiscan'tbehappening.net. Lots of good articles on there.